Good morning, everybody. Let me introduce myself. I'm Fred Wolf from Göttingen at the Max Planck Institute for Strömungsforschung. And today I'm going to present to you some work that, together with two very beautiful PhD students, Matthias Kaschub and Michael Schnabel, we did in collaboration with two experimental groups that do visual cortical development and visual cortical physiology. One is a long-term collaboration with Sigrid Löwe, the lab head of a group in neural development in the Leibniz Institute for Neurobiology in Magdeburg. The other is Hubert Dinse and Klaus Kreikemeyer at the University of Bochum. And the upshot of all I'm going to present to you, hopefully I'll manage to complete the presentation, will be that I hope to convince you that long-range interactions, things that are non-local in the brain, should be taken serious or have a strong say in shaping visual cortical architecture. If you want to learn more about these things, some of it is published. There's a Journal of Neuroscience paper 2 years ago and the European Journal of Neuroscience paper from last year. And the theory is partially presented in a JFSL Paris review paper from last year, and there will be lecture notes in neurophysics from Lesouch that will presumably be published this year that has most of the theory that I'm going to present. So I'll be concerned with the visual system, and let's briefly remind us of the usual things about the visual system. Of course, information is acquired by the eye and is transformed by the retina into a sequence, an array of electrical pulses that are transmitted via the LGN to the visual cortex. And here a lot of things happen. You may imagine that just because of the numbers, because there's like a factor of 1,000 between the number of neurons that are concerned with any stimulus in the visual world, in the retina, and likewise in the LGN and in the cortex. So this is where the processing power really is. And so one reason, one of the main reasons I'm really very fascinated about this structure is that it has become very accessible to precise assessments of the spatial structure, of the spatial organization of the neural circuits there by the development of optical imaging, brain imaging that uses light as the probe. So the idea there is that you expose the surface of the brain. That's a limitation. Here you can only visualize structures that are superficial in the brain and just shine light on it. That would be absorbed strongly by the oxyhemoglobin. And then you just take photographs, simply speaking. And if you do enough signal averaging, you can figure out what a particular stimulus presented to this animal in the living brain elicits as an activation pattern. And this method, the maturation of this method, has enabled to image one of the key structural layout elements of visual cortical circuitry in great detail, and that is the representation of stimulus orientations. And to familiarize you with this kind of data, I'll arrange a little animation here of data obtained by Len White and David Coppola in Duke University Fitzpatrick lab at that time. And there you see, I mean, it's an animation. It's not really what you would see in an experiment, but if you show the animal the stimulus shown in the upper picture, there are different activity patterns that are emerging in the cortical tissue. So this is a few on the cortical tissue. And if you imagine that you rotate these orientations, of course, this activation pattern will also start to change. And if you look closely, when you look closely at the detail, you see there are many points like this where your activation bubble goes like in a washing machine. And so when you look a little more at this movie, you see many places where this happens. And a convenient way to display this structure is to color code for every pixel, the orientation that elicits the largest response by a color code that represents the orientation of the stimulus. And that gives rise to the standard representation of this orientation maps.
That was actual data, right?
That was actual data.
Average over how many?
How many presentations? So you, in an everyday experiment, people used to take like 2 hours of imaging to obtain the data that is displayed there. But since a few years, the one guy in Kalatsky and Stryker introduced, so by adopting the presentation and data acquiring paradigm from fMRI, that you continuously present data and repetitively present the so gratings of rotating orientation, you might be able to acquire the necessary data in a few minutes now. So this is another development that will make it more practical to really get large amounts of high-precision data on the spatial layout of these structures. I want to point out two features. So these little washing machines go under the name of pinwheels. If you represent this orientation preference map, they are topological defects of the stimulus orientation as a function of cortical location, and they come in two varieties with a positive and negative topological charge, depending on whether you, when you circle this defect clockwise, either the orientation will change counterclockwise or clockwise, and then gives them a topological charge. In principle, one could imagine higher topological charges, and they were actually predicted. That's one of the predictions by Breitenberg that didn't work out. He predicted topological defects of the double charge. And eventually, I think Gary Blaisdell once found one such pinwheel. The other important feature here is that there is a typical length scale in here that you may imagine that you estimate the distance between any adjacent domain, any adjacent column of the same color, and that has a typical size. It's in the millimeter range, and I thought I put it in here, but apparently I didn't. So I will denote that as lambda, and this is, of course, a wavelength, a repetition length. Whereas I would like to point out from the very start, this pattern is not repetitive, it's not really periodic.
I think it's a holy one.
Pardon me?
How big is a holy one?
The what?
The holy one.
The holy one.
How big is it?
In the cat, it is like 4 square centimeters, so you would have several hundreds of these elementary structures in there. In the monkey, it's much larger. You have several thousands. So this is, okay, yeah, I'll come to that again. So this is a small fraction of the entire V1. This is a small fraction of the central representation of visual space in V1. Okay, you know all what's happening on the micro when you home in microscopically. These were classical studies by Hubel and Wiesel. And when you record spike activity from individual neurons, say in the green domain, what people report is that, okay, there's this one orientation encoded in green that drives this neuron most. I don't know whether if I were a neuron, I would prefer this orientation. There are other orientations that drive it less strongly. Those are actually the ones where most of the information is. And there is also an orthogonal orientation that may, in many cases, not elicit much response. Now, so I will argue that it's very revealing to consider this orientation map as the result of a pattern formation process. And this is, I find, the most striking evidence in that direction obtained in Suhr's lab a few years ago. Finally, after many previous attempts, where they showed that if you they managed by to misroute visual input into the nominally auditory cortex, and found that so when you let let an animal grow up with visual input routed to the visual thalamus to the auditory thalamus into the auditory cortex, and then recorded in the auditory cortex, both at the level of maps and at the level of single-cell tuning curves, they found behavior very reminiscent, hard to distinguish from the normal behavior of cells and maps in V1. And in a companion paper, actually, demonstrated that these rewired animals can use their auditory cortex to process visual information and guide behavior by that.
So is the talamus to cortex part is intact? Is the eye to talamus that is rerouted?
Yeah. So you make you have to make these animals deaf so that their MGB, the auditory primary thalamic nucleus, doesn't receive its genuine input, and to remove the LGN so that the retinal axons don't know where to go. They don't find their primary target, and then they go over to the auditory thalamic nucleus and contact there and get transmitted in the usual fashion from the auditory thalamus to the auditory cortex.
And it's in the
baby? That was done in ferrets that have, for experiments like this, have the advantage that they are born very immature. They open eyes at day 32 normally, so they have 1 month before normal vision starts in them. So it was not done before birth, I think. But it would correspond to something doing before birth in a human or in monkey. So I'd like to thank the organizer for providing this display. I put here one of the few examples from Mitya's papers that shows a non-optimum thing. Yeah? It's the last figure from his 2001 neuron paper. And so he put in, so this paper is on what the minimization of wiring would predict, wiring length would predict about the structure of orientation maps. But for some reason, in the last figure, he also put results of an incomplete minimization of the wiring length in there. And what? Pardon me? Yeah, no, it was a good job of the reviewer, I think. I was not the reviewer. Yes. And this is again our ferret orientation map, and maybe the reason that the reviewer was asking for this or for something in that direction is that if you really minimize the wiring length as they did, for many choices of your target function, do these layouts of orientation counts become very, very regular. And of course, if you don't really do it, then they look more like the real thing. And that raises the question, how optimal should we think this thing is? Of course, there are many arguments around. Of course, orientation is not the only thing the cortex represents. And there might be quenched noise, and where are the blood vessels, and so on. But it all amounts to say that, this is something heavily distorted. Yeah, biology does not care to do it better, or has some very hidden reasons. And this is really a somewhat tough pattern formation problem, because over the years, many people have tried their skills coming up with simple field theories for the arrangement of orientation columns. We had some input here, and Mitya, I mentioned this. This is a optimized layout for some penalty function on the wiring. This is a recent work by Kadar et al., Jack Cowan, and Peter Thomas. And all of these models have very beautiful solutions, but they are, as a rule, repetitive. They have a periodicity length, and they repeat exactly after one periodicity length. So if I were a biologist and would say, okay, these people calculate for years, and then they come up with these beautiful pictures, but it doesn't look very much like the real thing, so what should I really learn about it? Shouldn't I put it into the waste basket? Yeah?
We just have a couple of sentences of what goes into this model and what...
I wouldn't comment, yeah.
It's one of these groups I just want to say, it's one of these groups from Caltech, because I saw mm-hmm. a talk recently about a model of this, the Sloan meeting. Did you see that, Ichin?
Who's
talk? It was a guy from Caltech, I can't remember.
Post.
Oh, your post.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's your post.
Oh, that's right, just later.
Yeah, so doesn't his do a little better job of not this period?
This is kind of a null model, right? How much happens for 3 months, 1 year?
Yeah.
Yeah, this was just a descriptive model. It wasn't.
We had some simulations that looked pretty good as far
as. Yeah, but that was just basically what he did is he assumed a particular pinwheel structure, right. And then he put down things at random and added them up a particular way,
I see.
And you got things that look like that.
Yeah. Presumably, the scale of the structure is dependent on the spatial frequency of the stimulus being given to the animal.
It's not strongly. No, there's some discussion. So, if you the layout of where the orientation is activated most strongly is somewhat insensitive to the spatial frequencies of the stimulus. I mean, if you make the spatial frequency too large, you won't activate V1 and then instead activate V2 in the cat, for example. That's what happens. So there's some spatial frequency tuning and there's some interaction with orientation, but it's really a second order effect. What I was driven to ask myself is what are the ingredients into a model? Is there a model that has no quench disorder, no interaction with other maps, and still reproduces this irregular but roughly repetitive layout? And that's what I'm going to present to you in the second part of the talk. And I would like to start with what the main ingredient will be. And this is the ingredient that is essentially lacking in these previous attempts. So if you look at the small piece of V1 in the I have to draw a brain. Of course, the majority of the inputs that this little neuron receives is in the very vicinity of it. Yeah? That's a large majority of its synaptic input. And that is the reason why something fieldish, some local theory might be very appropriate to describe it. But on the other hand, many of these neurons have connections that go really somewhere else, for example, to V2 and get fed back. And similarly, some of them go down over to the other hemisphere and eventually feed back. So there might be also this network type of things that don't easily fit into a field picture that might play a role. And my aim will be to describe, to convince you that if you take these network aspects into account and try to squeeze them into a field picture, then you will find, I will present you a model that reproduces this aperiodic layout almost, I would say, quantitatively without any disorder and interaction with other maps. But before that, I would like to dive into data first and discuss with you or present you some recent work we did together with experimentalists that really indicates that these non-local interactions, things that happen in a really distant part of the brain and may feedback, can influence this structure. And the problem that we investigated there was the problem of wavelength selection. And after we've gone through this, so trying to find out what really sets this spatial periodicity scale, then I'll discuss more theoretically the problem of pattern selection. That is, what kind of pattern is it, stripes or these colored checkerboards or something even weird or something aperiodic? So that will be part one, and that will be part two. And so if you want to convince yourself that this is really a pattern formation problem, the first thing actually to check would be, do we have an idea what sets the wavelengths of this structure? That is how, for example, in convection, people started to understand how convection walls fight their scale and so on. And of course, there are two forces that drive the development. Actually, that's how it is usually conceived. I'm not so sure about it. And it would be a long story, and unfortunately unsuccessful story to tell you how people try to, by modification of experience, change the wavelength of these patterns. So far, there's no experimentally working paradigm that would affect the spacing of the patterns by different raising paradigms. For some years, it was a promising idea to have squinting animals, which strongly changes the intraocular correlations or the activity correlations from the two eyes, but leaves the amount of activity the same. But unfortunately, that does not, if you look closely at the data, there's really no significant difference between the spacing in squinting and in normal-sided animals, and all the other raising paradigms that we have investigated, they don't affect spacing. So, but of course, there's this other piece of information that goes in. Yeah?
Is there any known effect that the environment may change the wavelengths, but not on the scale of one animal, but on the scale of many generations?
Yeah, I mean, you'll see that there's
almost the same species living somewhere in the forest on different latitudes.
Okay, but that would, for example, work through this input into the developmental process. You could select, and actually, what these two neuroscience papers, the first one that I will present to some degree, shows that there's glutamate clustering of the wavelengths, so consistent with the idea that it has a heritable component that you could evolve it. And the second one showed that when you consider ocular dominance, then different breeds of cats significantly differ in their wavelengths. So, but I'm getting ahead of myself. So one way, of course, would be to change the genes and then see what happens to the brain. And actually, that was done. That's done actually every day in labs around the world. But there are tremendous examples where people knock in one gene that turns on some regulator of the cell cycle, and in a mouse you get a mouse that has a highly folded cortex. And we're fortunate that these mice don't live to see the day, because they die when they are born. But eventually, they will take over. And there is a long history, of course, of the influence of genetic information on cerebral structure and processing power. One came out just when we were rejected with our study, so I somewhat studied that. One of the latest results in human studies of genetic influence on cortical structure and on cognitive performance is this, 3 years ago in Nature Neuroscience, where they showed that they calculate actually maps of the correlation between gray matter volume, and showed that there are specific locations where in identical twins the correlation in the gray matter volume is larger, is significantly correlated between identical twins, and found that these differences even correlate with some measure of cognitive performance. So regional cortical volume was shown before and is a great candidate on how genetic heritable factors may influence cortical structure and cognitive abilities. But there are also reasons to doubt that we can find on the level of single columns influence of genetic factors, because while there's some known influence on cortical volume. Already when you look at the pattern of sulci and gyri, at the sulcal patterns, they are different, not significantly similar, even in identical twins. And therefore one might expect that if you go to the even finer level of the functional architecture, maybe there you would not be able to see something like this. But we were, and let me so briefly tell you. Yeah?
Can you just ask one quick question?
Sure.
So when they compared the volumes of regions in different brains, mm-hmm. on which scale did they do the comparison?
Below
the gyrus or above the gyrus?
I think it's below the gyrus, like areas. So they didn't resolve below. One region that was language cortex, like Broca and Wernicke areas, And they had no resolution below areas, as far as I
recall. So it's like 7 centimeter level.
Yeah.
Similarity.
Rather larger. Yeah.
Okay.
So we also in visual cortical development, there were during the 90s a resurgence of interest of the hypothesis that this structure might be entirely pre-specified, driven by work from Tobias Bonhoeffer and colleagues. And so we asked ourselves, maybe we can, so the high profile experiment there would be to have identical animals and see whether they have identical maps or not. But the low profile thing might also be worth doing if you quantify the variability within the population and then can you see similarity among relatives. That would be first hint that there is a detectable influence of genetic differences, genetic variability on the variability of these structures. So the data we used for the study were 2DG autoradiographs, which have the large advantage compared to optical imaging that you can display the entire visual cortex. So this is the entire V1, but you have only the columns labeled for one orientation. Actually, there's also V2 labeled here, and I will come to that, hopefully. And optical imaging, unfortunately, gives you only a very limited view on that structure. But with 2DG, you can, at least for one orientation, capture the entire thing. And
sorry, yep. Another interruption.
Yeah.
If you go in depth,
yeah.
Does the map change?
No, that's a very classical result. If you penetrate perpendicular to the cortical surface, then many things change, but the preferred orientation is almost constant. I mean, this structure, the cortex, is really a thin sheet of tissue. It's 1 millimeter to 2 millimeters thick, and several centimeters this area. And in the third direction, there's a lot of circuits coupling them really tightly together. And there's a few outlying papers that ever saw in a perpendicular. I'm talking about cat and monkey cortex. It's a different thing in lower mammals. Yeah? But in cat and monkey cortex, there's this columnar organization that's not specific to the visual cortex. You find it in all the sensory cortexes and many other cortices. That neurons stacked on top of each other in the C direction do very related things and share many of these functional parameters.
The orientation changes with depth.
Pardon me?
Preferred orientation changes with depth.
No, that's what I say. It's preferred orientation is basically a 2D thing. It changes with X and Y, but not with the depth.
So even if you're going down a column,
yeah,
orientation doesn't change.
That's the definition of orientation column. I mean, if it changed, it would not be an orientation column.
Okay.
So we. When you look at this pattern, you may realize that it's not entirely homogeneous. So there are there's difference in labeling strengths, but also in the layout of the columns. In some regions they are very patchy, in others they are stripe-like. They don't appear to have exactly the same spacing all over the place. So we decided that we would like to estimate for each local patch of V1 what its typical spacing was, and then look at the statistics of these local column spacings, local wavelengths. And we did that with the wavelet method. So you take this Gabor-like function in different magnifications and different orientations and find the one that matches best the local structure and its spatial scale. That is what we defined as the local wavelength at this position. Can go across the entire area and thereby calculate a wavelength map, a map of local wavelength as a function of position in V1, and do statistics of these. So the two things that I will consider is the mean wavelength and the standard deviation of this wavelength histogram, which we call the spacing inhomogeneity. And by using many sections from the same hemisphere, and we could estimate these two with pretty high precision, like 15 micron range for the wavelength and for the spacing inhomogeneity. And this is really a crazy thing. Why would you do this? And it's a scale in the millimeter range. And it always, when I present this, always reminds me of when I was a student and visited Wolf Singer's lab. He gave us a little tour, and he did not know I was a physicist, but he had a few physics students in his lab. And then when we passed by, he told us actually how it is that physicists are such terrible neuroscientists. And it is for the reason that they always want to measure things much too precise, much more precise than makes any physiological sense. And this is one of these examples. Sure, I mean, if you know it's 1 millimeter or two, that's biologically relevant information, but it's whether it's 1.17 or 1.15 millimeters, who cares? One might think.
Just, yep. I think I missed something. So when you have these Gabor functions, you choose two numbers, right? The width of the Gaussian and then the wavelength.
Yep.
So where are these two numbers? And how different are they?
The results are not sensitive on their choice. If you vary them, you get the similar results. And the rationale for choosing them is that you want to have
You want local average.
Exactly. Right. You want something that is local enough but has some resolution in k-space also. So that's a trade-off.
Right, but then the width of the Gaussian is like the size of your patchiness, and then the wavelength is the size of your characteristic scale in your pattern.
Ah, well. So you take these are this is a wavelet basis. So you take magnified versions of one mother wavelet. So that doesn't determine your result. Yeah? So actually how much overlap you get depends on what exactly the function is that you choose. So I mean you can superimpose magnified versions of this wavelet on the same pattern, and the overlap will go down. Similar if you take smaller versions. And that's the comparison that is done to estimate the best matching wavelet and the estimate of the local wavelength. And these two, I mean, the first thing to realize is that these two parameters actually are largely independent. So if you might imagine if you have the animal with the larger wavelength, it has just a broader histogram, but that's not really the case. So maybe the first thing to mention is that there is a strong variability. So the largest average, so this is graph of average wavelength against spacing inhomogeneity, and the largest columns we had in that data set was like 1.4 millimeters average spacing, and the smallest are in the 1 millimeter range. So there's the intra-species, the inter-individual variability of this wavelength is much larger than our measurement error. So we can seriously partition them into guys with large and small wavelengths, and likewise with high and low spacing inhomogeneity. And then these two have little to say about each other. If you leave out this data point, they are virtually uncorrelated. The correlation is very low.
Yeah. Fred, do you know how lambda varies with eccentricity?
Excellent question. I'll come to that. That's very interesting. Actually, that's... So this is a... I mean, this is to explain Jack's question. So one should keep in mind how visual space is mapped onto CatV1. And so this is a visual coordinate system, the vertical meridian, the horizontal meridian, and different iso, what's that called? Other angular lines going into the periphery. And this is mapped topographically onto the surface of the cortex such that the lower part of the visual field is mapped in this part of the visual cortex, and the upper part in the lower part of the visual cortex. And one classical finding is that the central 5 degree, for example, in the cat visual cortex, are largely overrepresented compared to the peripheral representation. But if you look at this spatial map of column spacing of local wavelengths, it is roughly homogeneous. So regions that have a high magnification factor and a much lower magnification factor still have very comparable column sizes. There are small differences, and I'll analyze them in a second. But there's nothing that strikes the eye if you look at your first example.
Can I ask something?
Sure.
So, since Wolf Singer is not here, pretend I'm a more some neuroanatomist.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to say, well, you know, the way you do this preparation involves some tissue shrinkage and involves flattening of the cortex.
Uh-huh.
And there's a pretty radical kind of geometrical transformation that could change things by a factor of two. How do you control those things from animal to animal so that you can do this comparison durability and the intercom spacing?
Mm. So first of all, there's little tissue shrinkage in this data set because the animals were not perfused. The ideal thing to do and what we're really accumulating data on is to do first optical imaging and then do this preparation and then compare how representative is your 2DG estimate of the wavelength for the in vivo estimate of the wavelength. So that would be the best thing one could do to compare. Then in the cat, much of the visual cortex does not have intrinsic curvature, so it is relatively easy to flatten in comparison to monkey visual cortex, for example. And what we did was, when we had these wavelength maps, and you ask yourself, is the structure in it a relation caused by unfolding of the cortex, or is it due to intrinsic differences in the column spacing? And what we utilized was the fact that the V1, and if you cut the brain, so this is lateral and that is medial. The visual cortex in the cat has these two sulci between the hemispheres, and if there's a systematic effect of flattening, and these sulci are pretty stereotypical. If there is a systematic effect of flattening, we should see a systematic effect that correlates with a systematic error that correlates with the structure of the sulci. And we couldn't find that. So that was one thing that convinced us that the structure that we're seeing is not related to the unfolding and flattening. And I will show you more striking findings that indicate that it's really intrinsic. I'll skip them. So the simplest question you can ask is the one here: how many hypercolumns are there? And a reasonable estimate for the number of hypercolumns is take the area of the area and divide it by the area of the hypercolumn, estimated, guess lambda square is the order of this area. And there's a huge variability between animals, between 250 something and 400 hypercolumns in V1. And it is also, so the area size and hypercolumn size for all the people that are interested in scaling laws are also pretty much independent of each other. So you have large areas with relatively small hypercolumns and small areas with relatively high hypercolumns. They don't scale with one another. That's the reason why the hypercolumn number is so variable between animals. And that might influence performance in some way. But let me homing in this genetic influence issue. So in our data set of 30-something animals, there were 6 litters. So that's a schematic representation of these data sets. And the cats that are litter mates are coded by the same color, and whether their brain is dark or not depends on how many hemispheres were reconstructed successfully. So you could ask yourself, if you draw randomly, animals or floor ones that are genetically related, closely related, is there an influence on the statistics of the wavelength? And that is the wavelength from one of these litters. And this is, for comparison, the total variability of the current wavelength. And you see that they stick much closer together than if you randomly drew them. And that is true for many of their colleagues. So whereas these litters, they were all raised in the same visual environment, fed by the same people, in the same, and processed by the same experimentalist. So where they cover this inter-animal variability pretty much, they stick together fairly tightly. But of course, there are also counterexamples, litters that are spread. And I mean, I probably don't need to remind you that they are not genetically identical. They are just sisters and brothers. They share a fraction of their genes, but not all of them. And in addition, some of them might have two different fathers. That's possible among cats. So littermates have different fathers. So what you have to do is to assess whether this is significant. And we did that in two ways. First of all, we randomly assembled pseudo brains, pairs of hemispheres that we assigned, OK, you are the two hemispheres of one brain. And then assembled these pseudo brains into pseudo litters and calculated the average distance from the litter mean in this data set. And you see that is the actual expected average distance from the litter mean. So that's like 0.040 microns. So the average distance, if you pick one guy from its litter mean, is 30 microns in the wavelength. And then it's very short compared to randomly composed pseudo litters. And you could also say, well, the brains are correlated. You should not choose random brains and assemble them into litters. Just leave the brains that are left and right hemisphere pairs together and assemble random litters from them. But then it's still significant. So the significance to reject the hypothesis that you would find this degree of clustering by chance is also under this conservative assumption lower than 1%.
Basically ANOVA.
Yeah, it is like ANOVA. We didn't do ANOVA because we could not really. I mean, you have a very, with six litters, you can't really estimate heritability and so on. So we are happy with being able to reject the hypothesis that it's statistically independent. You can try to calculate the fraction that would be explained by fraction of variance that would be explained by genetic factors. And it comes out 0.5, like.
So over there you have lambda for the rotated squares, the diamond things.
Yeah.
That's just one number for the whole animal. How do you get that? You use the average over all the measurements for an animal.
Yeah. So how did we get that? One symbol stands for one hemisphere. So that's the left and the right hemisphere of one cat, and that's the left and the right hemisphere of its sister cat.
Yeah.
And for the typical hemisphere, we had like six sections, so whole mount sections, 50 micron thick, and estimated the wavelength for each section separately, and then calculated the average wavelength of that section, and then we could average over the sections, and that's how you gain some accuracy. And this,
data for cats that were not related genetically but were brought up in the same way?
Yeah, that's these histograms. If you just assemble groups of cats brought up in the same environment.
I thought they were in the same
environment. No. Yeah.
I don't know. I heard about some experiments which were going to be done. I don't know whether it could be done. What? To raise cats in a particularly strange environments. For example, put them in a dark room where you show them only lines on a certain direction.
Yeah, sure. These are classical experiments, yeah.
Yes. And so, have you, are there data on those funny to...
There's lots of data. This is a long and fascinating story, different rearing. I would like to continue here, and I would be happy to discuss this with you later. So the upshot is that if you do dark rearing or stripe rearing, this horse has mild effects on the structure of the maps. Nothing that would compare, hardly noticeable. Many people would say it's virtually identical. But there's a long controversy. For example, what stripe rearing does in the 70s, it was like only the experienced orientation is represented, and the cortex does not care about the experience at all, and so it is. There are slight overrepresentation of your experienced orientations, but strikingly, orientations never experienced have beautiful columns in these visual cortices. So that these varying experiments have very weak influences as far as one can tell so far. So it's maybe if I come to it, I will show you an experimental manipulation that strongly affects the structure of the maps. But only very recently was that found. So there was this question about the dependence on eccentricity, and the next question we thought we should address was whether this is consistent with the idea that there is some genetic influence on the spacing of the columns. And so first of all, I should stress that this does not mean that this structure is genetically programmed. You would expect that from any scheme, because even if it's totally self-organized and depends only on synaptic plasticity in development, these plasticity rules have some cell biological parameters, and of course they are under genetic control. So even in the most experience-driven scenario, you would expect that the quantitative features of the structures that you build can be dependent on genetic information, no question. That doesn't have a say on whether it's predetermined or whether it is self-organized or whether it is learned or not. But we were the first to nail it down because we estimated this quantity so precisely. Now there's this, if you can do, you would like to know, is there a specific control of the wavelength in V1 and a specific control of the wavelength in V2? Or is there? So there seems to be some control. That's my first conclusion. But is it area specific or is it just a global thing? For example, one may ask, is it just the fat cats that have these huge columns? And it's not correlated with body size, for example. So it's not a general growth factor that we are addressing here. It's brain specific, but we want to know whether it's area specific. And fortunately, in the same set of autoradiographs, Sigrid used a set of stimuli that had large and small spatial wavelengths, so that area 18 and area 17, V2 and V1, were equally strongly activated. So we could do the same thing for V2 and obtain a spacing map for V2 and for V1 in a given hemisphere. And you could ask yourself what have to do with one another, and that will lead us to discuss the question of eccentricity also. And to do this comparison in a transparent way, we choose to decompose these maps into three components. This is like a variance decomposition in the end. So you can build any, say, V1 orientation map from, you take its average value, that's the first estimate of the spacing map, same average spacing all over the place, but you see, okay, there's structure in there. You add the systematic topographic variation, which is you can at each position average over all the hemispheres. So that is the, if you ask in my randomly grabbed animal, what is the average wavelength at this position in V1, the answer that you get somewhat depends. It's not totally flat. The hemisphere average spacing map. And then, of course, these two don't combine together with the actual measurement. There's some component that makes this map specific. That's the map of this animal K something. And therefore, we call this the individual topographic variation. So you can discriminate these three components, the mean, the systematic topographic variation, And the individual deviation from the population averaged map. And so to give you a feeling how strong these contribute, these are really variance components. So the smallest component actually is the systematic topographic variation. So if this is the entire variance of column spacings, you grab a random column from a random hemisphere and look at the distribution, what is the variability? That is the entire length of this bar, and the different color-coded segments are the fractions of variance brought by the mean, by the topographic systematic variation, and by the individual topographic variation. So the mean provides the smallest variance component. That is where the smallest variance component is where we found the genetic influence, this littermate clustering. The second largest. There is a systematic topographic variation, but it's the smallest variance component. So there is, in that sense, there is not a strong impact of position in V1 on the spacing, but there is one. And the largest proportion is this individual topographic variation, what makes your spacing map special for that hemisphere.
I never asked you that, but I'm still confused.
Yeah.
So the green one.
Yeah.
Would that quantity be different from animal to animal?
Yeah, exactly.
Average over animal.
No, this is the mean column spacing for this hemisphere. This is the quantity I talked about.
Average across the animals.
No, this is not average. This is averaged across the hemisphere. You have for each average, so hemisphere. I will count hemispheres for each hemisphere. We have a spacing map lambda I of x. X is position in the cortex. Now you can average this over the cortex. Lambda I x averaged over space. That is the average spacing of animal I. And that is the green thing. And then you can also average this lambda I of x over the hemispheres and subtract the average spacing such that the thing that you obtain has zero average. So it's the
When you say average over hemispheres, I mean an animal has two hemispheres. You average over one over two, or is that averaging across animals?
That's average across animals and across hemispheres. You mirror invert the left hemispheres. Okay. And superimpose them. Such that the vertical meridian and horizontal meridian superimpose. Right.
But yeah. You have normalized these two things for V1 and V2.
Yeah.
The whole thing is not the same in V1.
The whole thing is not the same. So this is V2. This is V1. It's a bit larger in V2. You see that. This is for comparison occur dominance in V1. For which the entire variance is substantially smaller than for V1. So, for example, for occur dominance, we cannot see littermate clustering, and presumably that is because occur dominance spacings stick together much more tightly across the animals.
Green variance is a variance across animals.
Oops. Yeah.
Of the quantity average within one animal.
Yeah.
Okay. Blue variance is the variance within one area. Averaged over all animals.
Yeah.
So this is a different.
Sure. Yeah.
Variance.
Yeah.
And yellow is the variance.
Is the residual variance? Everything that you didn't capture.
Variance averaged over all animals?
No. There's some. Okay, you want to explain the variability of spacing, say, in this position. That has only these two. How should I? I have to work on this on this presentation. Sure. But I wanted to put it in. I'm sorry. Yeah. So you are thinking about animals and space and so on, but you. Take a different viewpoint and say, well, I give you a 2x2 millimeter piece from one of the hemispheres in the data set. And you can estimate from that what is the spacing of this. And you get many of these pieces and acquire statistics. And it has a variance. There's a variability. How is it explained? You want to explain this entire variability. Part of it is due to these columns come from different animals. Part of it is due to these columns come from different pieces in V1. That contributes to the variability. That's the blue part. And then there's something that says even that is the individual deviation. You have a larger variability than what you would have if just the mean and the position dependence were there. And that is the yellow thing.
But this map, yeah, the yellow map, will be different for every animal.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So when you calculate the variance, do you average over map of one animal, or do you?
Okay. So this is averaged over space and over position.
Over space and over position, what's the difference?
Over animal, over hemisphere, and over position.
But maybe that's why that variance is bigger. I mean, how can you compare? That's what I understand. I'm trying to understand the significance of your result of the parent variances. And I can't understand it because I think you're comparing variances. Uh-huh. Different variances, and so of course they will be different.
It's not important that the I will not interpret this components. It's just the structure of the data set, and let's discuss whether it has meaning scientifically or not later. It tells you you can just read it here. So this has a smaller magnitude, the blue color scale, than the red one, and there's a. If you want, so the sense of this decomposition is that this is not spatially homogeneous, and that will be important. That's the point. This is not spatially homogeneous, and you want to take apart the spatial homogeneity that is shared, that is typical for if you go in the different animals into this position in V1, you have different sizes, but there's an average size, and it will be different from the size at the center of Gaze representation and so on. So this is, there's an average spatial dependence that's captured by the blue map. But so there's an additional component here that makes this hemisphere have its specific spacing map. And this is the red component. So I think it makes perfect sense to take these two components apart. And of course, if you want to build the entire map, it has non-zero average. You better add the average value of this hemisphere. But it's a unique decomposition that gives you what really makes this map special in this animal as spatial dependence is concerned, as opposed to its average value. Okay. I'll go briefly across the correlation between V1 and V2 average spacings. As consistent with all previous reports, the V2 spacing, which is here the squares, is larger than the V1 spacing. There are some V1 spacings that are, so they are overlapping the distributions, but in each hemisphere, its V2 spacing is larger than its V1 spacing, and they are significantly correlated, and so the diagonal would be here. So always is V2 lambda V2 larger than V1. So this was a bit disappointing. If there's this control of the two spacings, it is consistent with a single factor that controls both the spacing in V1 and V2. Then we looked at the blue map, which is now the hemisphere averaged. Individual averaged spacing map. So let's go through this. So there is the light portions are the larger than average columns, and the dark portions are the darker than average columns. The thick line is the average value, and this is plus and minus one sigma. And you see there's a systematic dependence. We have the largest columns in the center of Gaze representation, along the representation of the horizontal meridian and in the far periphery. There are typically smaller than average columns in the upper and lower representation of the vertical meridian. And intriguingly, in V2, the V2 map is looks like the mirror inverted version of this. So to bring this out more clearly, what we did was to map V2 into V1 coordinates, so mirror invert and stretch it such that major landmarks would become superimposed, like the horizontal meridian representation and the periphery representation. It's not just a linear thing. We took a nonlinear map that was trained on the average retinotopy of V1 and V2, and that. But it's the upshot is a very similar result. So here we have these two mountains of very large columns in the periphery, and there are also two mountains of larger than average columns in the periphery representation of V2, and the overall structural is conserved between the two. You wouldn't be surprised to find something like this in the vicinity of the aerial border, because there must be some continuity. But the most striking things happen far away from the aerial border, and that is the one phenomenon that convinces us most that these spatial variations are not a reflection of the unfolding. What would make, if these are artifacts of the unfolding, why would the V2 that is on an entire different gyrus be unfolded in a correlated fashion? So this finding was what convinced us that we should take this topographic related structure serious. You may ask, is it also reflected in the ocular dominance columns? Yes, there's a strong correlation between the ocular dominance column average spacing and the orientation column average spacing. So there's, as you asked, there's this position dependence in the visual field. It has a magnitude of like 300 micron. But the striking thing is this is similar between V1 and V2. Speaking in favor of that wavelength selection happens in a coordinate fashion in V1 and V2. And we know, of course, that the columns that have similar average wavelengths here look at similar portions of the visual field and are mutually connected to one another. So there is a substrate for such an interaction, actually. But of course, we became curious. Can we see it in every case? Can we see it in the individual component? I'm going to skip the second part of the talk. I'm sorry for that. And you can. So this is an example where you can see it where we could see it in the individual column layout. So what we did was to take these four pieces and magnify them such, scaled the space variable such that all the differences in spacing that were due to different average spacings and different average space dependence would be scaled out, and all the remaining size differences are due to the individual component. And you see that these are larger spacing columns, these are smaller spacing columns. They look at similar portions of the visual field in V1 and V2. And when you look at the red map, which is the residual part of the variability, you see it also shares the major features. There's this larger than this individually large piece of cortex, and there's something at the corresponding location. There's this butterfly structure with a peak here. It is also there in the V2. These red components of the spacing map are very individual. There are, if you take another cat, it has a very different red map. So it has, this one has its largest columns in the upper part of the vertical meridian representation, and over there. But it's also the case in its V2. And so in our data set, this is really a significant trend towards similarity of V2 and V1 individual components. And so when we saw that, we thought maybe we should double check. It's not, I mean, it's many maps in comparison to other studies, but maybe it's something special. How, what would be an independent test of this apparent principle that columns that look at the same position of the visual field have correlated wavelengths? So as I said, there are also columns on the other hemisphere. And the if you look at the entire visual field, there's a a part of the visual field ipsilateral that is also represented in the contralateral hemisphere, or in the same hemisphere. So there's a 5 degrees, is it, in the CAD region around the vertical meridian that is represented in both hemispheres, and that is selectively connected by callosal connections. So we ask ourselves, can we see this tendency towards similar wavelengths also in left-right comparison if we look only at the in the vicinity of the vertical meridian representation? And so these are scaled subsections where we took out the systematic components from the two hemispheres. You don't have to take out the average wavelength because it's correlated anyway in left and right. And they share their size, at least, maybe more. And so you can, so the, let's look at the red component of the spacing map, which is very telling here. So for example, if you take look at the periphery representation of the left V1 and of the right V1, they are very different. So we have a blob of large columns over here. There's nothing comparable down here. If you restrict yourself to the vicinity of the aerial border, the vicinity of the vertical meridian representation in both areas, then the spacing changes in a coordinated fashion. We have this larger columns up here. There's also larger columns up here, smaller columns down here, smaller columns down here. And that's this left-right similarity is even more significant. Whereas we have less examples. So that convinces us that there is this it's a bit, I mean, it has many aspects, this finding. So first of all, we really think that wavelength selection is happening. This, what the wavelength that these columns become, they is set by some factor. We don't exactly know which. We can speculate about it. But it happens in a non-local fashion. It happens in a coordinated way in V1, in V2, in the two hemispheres, as long as these columns are mutually connected. And in so counter our expectations, so the average tells you there's some common factor for V1 and V2, but it seems to be something common that is topographically specific. So something common that tells this column to be like this column and this column to be like this column, and not this global growth signal that would tell all the columns be larger in this angle or be smaller in this angle. So that gives me essentially no time to cover the role of non-locality in pattern selection. But maybe I could present that at another time during the week. So,
Okay, alternatively, we could reschedule it for later this afternoon.
Okay, I'll. How much time do you estimate? It's I'm halfway through, so
let's okay, so let's do it in the afternoon. That's
Okay.
Like that.
There's
the blackboard topic.
Yeah.
Well, that's why it's 12:15. I mean, it could be any other day as
we can do. But yeah. Very let's put another day.
So okay.
There's not so many talks in Monday.
Yeah. So, how much more afternoon?
Yeah, everything's fine with me.
Oh, actually, maybe Wednesday?
Wednesday would fit with the the V1 Wednesday?
Let's do it on Wednesday.
Yeah.
Wednesday, 4 p.m. All right.
Great, yeah.
Okay.
Thanks so much for your attention.
Thank you.